Pinch Punch, first of the month. Welcome to The Naked Englishman. I'm Richard Vobes. This is the audio diary of my life behind the scenes of a YouTube creator. It is the 1st of June, 2025. That is a slurp of coffee. And it's 6:30 in the morning. 6:30 in the morning, I'm downstairs in my front room peering out. It is overcast. Earlier, I did wake up a little bit at just after 4:30 and peered out the window, amazed that it was as bright as it was. It was foggy then. I think the fog is clearing. Anyway,
excuse me, yawny.
Bit of yawnage there. So yesterday was a good day for production. Got another chapter done, pretty much. Got a couple of pages that need attention on the excuse me, on the transposing. And what else did we do? Went down to the town with Julia briefly. Well, onto the seafront, had an ice cream, sat on the beach, exercised the kids, got her kids out. We were aiming to go up on the downs. And the sun came out, and then the sun went in, and it was misty and cold. Well, not cold, but in contrast. And I said to Julia, I did say to Julia, I'm not quite sure what the day is going to do. It's a funny old day, isn't it? Can't make up its mind. So we popped out down to the town, and the sun came out again, and then it promptly went back in again. And you could see some very curious chemtrailing in the skies. Oh, my goodness, they were going mad. So, quite rightly today, I say quite rightly, as a result, it is overcast, but never mind. We are into June, and a couple of people, I put out in my videos the other day that I was interested in people, if they were up for it, organising a book tour. Well, not a tour, but if I had enough people who were curious to with these groups, you know, there's a lot of groups that meet, it seems, up and down the country, these freedom groups, that if there was enough of them, maybe they could arrange that I came along, did a talk and sold my books. And a couple of people have been in touch about that, which has been fantastic. So, you know, it's nice to know that somebody somewhere, other than me and Julia, is looking forward to the launch of the book. And then another friend of mine wants to organise a whole tour of a launch. So that's really good. So, it seems to be coming in. Got to do it because... need the money. I've been demonetized now, it seems like forever. Goodness knows how we managed to keep going. But the donations from people have been absolutely, second to none. I cannot fault people. And why would you want to? Came up with another idea for a book, just loosely. And if you watch today's pipe smoking video, I mention a little bit of it. So that's quite funny. Hopefully people will enjoy that. What else has been going on? I'm pausing every now and again to just get the tired yawns out without making too much noise. I'm trying to do it just as discreetly as possible. Yeah, I was just basically working on the books yesterday. And I should do something similar, and if it's nice, probably nip out this afternoon or something with Julia and the kids or whatever. She's hopefully going singing tomorrow morning, this morning, at her choir, which isn't a church choir. It's a folk song choir type thing she does. I think they only do it on the first and second Sundays of the month, something like that. So she has to work out where they're doing it, because they have two different venues depending on. One is a lovely barn in Sullington and the other one is somewhere else. And if there's a wedding on or an event on, obviously they they go to the other place. But the barn is a beautiful venue to do it. It's very lovely. Let me have another slurp. I have been enjoying, in between my workings, I have been enjoying a book which I bought the other day by R.F. No, by, who is it actually by? Marion Lindsay Noble is her name. I'm going to put the light on because I may read a little bit from this. Hang on, I've got to find the button. Button Moon, you are a baboon. So this is a biography about R.F. Delderfield. Now, of course, I've got myself into a nice comfortable position, but there's nowhere to put the microphone here. Hang on a minute. And it says on the back here, see, I've been enjoying God is an Englishman. I have read To Serve Them All Their Days. I read One Way Ticket or something, I think it's called. And we're in the middle of Post of Honour. And isn't there one more I've read? I like his writing style. Oh, yeah, A Summer's Day. I like his writing style and I wanted to know more about it. And one of the things I wanted to know was how he wrote, the process, how long he wrote each day. He was a prolific writer and would tap out at some point when he was writing, I think God is an Englishman, towards the end of his life. He was writing, apparently, 6 hours a day, 7 days a week. He got into a rhythm and he'd had this kind of rhythm, that's what he liked to do, and just, but he wasn't terribly fit. I mean, he did try to do walks and things, it seems, but he set himself these deadlines, and then no doubt there were pressure from the publishers, but he had this rhythm to sit there at an old typewriter, I mean, you know, and he's typing it out and then handing them over to somebody else who's editing them. That's the advantage that he had, that once he started writing, he was able to write and then not, I don't think he did a lot of editing. I can't quite work out what's going on here. But anyway, I've got to get into a better position so that I can read a bit to you from this biography. It's a strange biography because it flits all over the place. But I'm enjoying it. It's only a slim little novel, a slim little book. Right. There are many bits that I wanted to... So when I say it nips all over the place, it doesn't go in date order. And where are you? I've moved you right over there, and then I'm over here. Here I am. And he moves about. He's often on the move himself, which is quite strange. They're moving almost every other day, it seems. Presumably they've rented accommodation. They've got children. Poor old wife, who came from Manchester, May, she has a couple of children who are stillborn. You know, that's really sad. And then I'm not quite sure whether they manage to get their own or whether they begin to adopt. Anyway, so he's born in 1912. And uprooted by the age of 11 when his family took over the West Country newspaper. And there the adolescent Ron was trained in the craft of writing and discovered his love of words. This is just the sort of what's written on the back. Shortly after the beginning of the Second World War, he joined the RAF and wrote one of the longest-running wartime comedies to be staged on the West End. His plays and film scripts launched and furthered the careers of the now famous actors like Sean Connery, Thora Hird, and Cyril Cusack. So I'm going to read a bit from Chapter 6. Called Exmouth and the Grange, brackets 1923 to 1926. The Delderfields had outgrown the Addiscombe Avenue. Moreover, Ron's father, William James Delderfield, then 50 years of age, had become restless and disillusioned with his job at Smithfield's Market. He was fed up with the daily train journey, starting at 3:40 a.m. every morning from Woodside Station, which became particularly uncomfortable in the winter. The break was participated when a change in job with a view of a partnership didn't materialise. Shortly afterwards, a neighbour of the Delderfields, who originated from Devon, returned from holiday and reported that he'd seen a business going cheap in Exmouth. Mr. Delderfield did not take long to make snap decisions. He bought the business and informed his wife and sons they would move to the southwest. This is the Delderfield Senior, you understand. The business comprised printing works, a stationery, wool and toy shop, and a weekly newspaper, all housed in a three-storey building called Berlin House in the main street of Exmouth. Mrs. Delderfield hated being uprooted from the genteel suburban life, but was mollified by the prospect of running the shop and delegating the wretched household chores to a maid. Mr. Delderfield and his second eldest son, Eric. Oh, yes, so they must have. Yes. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. He has a brother called Eric. Ron Delderfield, which is the writer. Yes, I was getting confused then about which one was having the still babies. It's Ron and May, but he's yet to meet May. Although he has all this, we've done all this earlier on. So as I say, it's some stuff that's up to date, stuff that's behind, not up to date now, because unfortunately poor old Ron is dead. I'm not making it very easy to understand, am I? Anyway, Mr. Delfield's second son, i.e. Ron's brother, eldest son, Eric, went the week before Christmas to prepare the arrival of the rest of the family. Now, how old is Ron? He says he's, I don't know how old he was. He wasn't, well, 1912. When was this? 23. So, if that's his 12, that's only 10 years. He must have been 10. His eldest brother, I think he's only 10, not that much older than him. But I suppose if it's 10 years older than him, he'd be 20. So maybe at 20, people grew up, didn't they, much quicker in those days, before we went through perhaps the 60s and 70s, where we allowed people to have a bit more of a childhood. Would that be fair? Is that about right? You tell me. Anyway, the eldest son went the week before Christmas to prepare the arrival for the rest of the family. Ron and his mother followed on Christmas Eve. Oh, I see. It's not just his second son. Sorry, I read that a bit weird. Mr. Delderfield and his eldest son went. I thought it read his eldest son. His eldest son, I think, is about 15. And I was thinking that was a bit strange that you would send a 15-year-old to go and prepare a business. I'm clearly still asleep. I beg your pardon, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, the partners of the business lived on the first floor, while the Delderfields occupied the top floor. In the general chaos of moving from Surrey to Devon, all of Ron's Christmas presents had been mislaid until they were discovered piece by piece around mid-January. Oh, that's a shame, isn't it? Their new home was a treasure trove. The boys spent weeks exploring it, supervised only superficially by a new maid called Gert. She was 19, sandy-haired and blue-eyed, and, to the delight of her two unruly charges, absolutely irrepressible. She came from an enormous family in the West Country, a sea captain, who had gone down with his ship in a storm. Gert told her family's history with the lovely burr of the West Country dialect, which kept Ron enthralled. He never seemed to get enough of her stories about the numerous sisters and her 100-year-old grandmother, who lived there. Oh, you got a grandmother? Oh, are, yes, indeed. Oh, that'd be right, that'd be. A grandmother and a sea captain, see? Ron was very fond of Gert, who seemed to be solely in charge of him. While doing her chores, she taught him every verse and every chorus of the smash hit, of every smash hit between 1923 and 1926. Her favourite was Felix Kept On Walking. Felix Kept On Walking. I don't know how it goes. Never heard of it. She also taught him to dance the foxtrot and took him to visit her friends in the rural areas behind Exmouth. Whenever he had a misadventure, she would screen him from authority, and it was she who took the responsibility for him becoming a Treasure Island addict at the age of 12. She had given him a beautifully illustrated edition for his birthday, which he read aloud to her as she went about her duties. Sounds like me, really. Around the same time, he discovered Huckleberry Finn, which he found absolutely fascinating. He reread both copies so often that they soon fell to bits, but they remained his most favourite copies for the rest of his life. Ron teamed up with Teenie, one of Gert's family, Teenie, who was a dedicated worshipper of the screen as much as Ron was. Gert, as in the silver screen. Gert used to give him sixpence for the cinema on the condition that he would return the favour to her with a blow-by-blow account of each film afterwards. Early talkies back then, in 1923, would have been, wouldn't it? The move to Exmouth, 12 miles south of Exeter, had been an astounding piece of good fortune as far as his passion for the cinema was concerned, because it multiplied his choice of cathedrals by four, and that in 1923, in the town, 11,000 inhabitants. Oh, so they had four cinemas in 19... Well, of course, it would have been all the rage back then. It only cost sixpence to see shows from 6 to 11 p.m. No one could have shown more ingenuity than young Ron to stave off bankruptcy and to pretend to fit in homework and piano practice. He covered his traces with the help of new won friends and often managed to confuse his mother, who always tried but rarely succeeded, in hauling him out of the movie hall. She finally issued an edict that he was to see one cinema show per week, which was the start of a non-stop game of cat and mouse. Anyway, I'll leave it there. He does talk about his books, or the or biographer, Marion Lindsay Noble, does talk about his books, and they come and go, the noise of the clatter. It is fascinating. And, of course, back then, 100 years ago, we're talking about 100 years ago, it's amazing, isn't it? So much, the 20th century was born, really, wasn't it? You had the cinema, which was influencing all sorts of people. For the first time, people in the West Country were beginning to see life outside their district. These glamorous film stars and these rather convoluted storylines, which I guess up until then had been, well, Victorian books would have been the closest, and the occasional play, if you were lucky enough or inclined to go. And the 20th century rolls on, and of course we get radio, which would have made different regional accents, although not really to begin with, clipped accents from the BBC, the received pronunciation. This is the BBC Home Service, and now a programme for deluded listeners with cheese and bacon sandwiches. It is presented by Mr. Goldworthy Gimbat. Hello, I am Mr. Goldworthy Gimbat. Today we're going to be looking at the fine art of cooking, and I shall be looking and then partooking in eating some of the food that we take. With me is Chief Chef Maurice Merintat. Maurice, could you tell us exactly what you're cooking today? Ah, yes, I can tell you. Anyway, losing myself into a load of old nonsense here. The 20th century rolls on, isn't it? 100 years ago, And within that 100 years ago, these dark forces have reared their ugly heads, persuading hospitals to ditch some of their practices, like the Tesla machines, and some of the astounding new ways to heal people, and go down with the petrochemicals based on oil and plastics. And we see, do we not, science, this strange term, which has been around for a bit, but in the past, you know, you'd see your doctor or you'd see your physician, and he would he wouldn't so much doctor you, but he would try and heal you with you know, more natural lotions and potions. And now we start to see these fake keep them ill, keep them ill so we can make a fortune pills come out. And here we are, you know, we have the terms of at the speed of science, which of course is laughable. Laughable. What does that mean, the speed of science? It's more the speed of gullibility, I would say. And the 20th year, 100 years ago, it's... And what a time to be alive, if, like anywhere really, if you have sufficient funds to avoid poverty. It is interesting, isn't it? Because they, I'm just thinking now about poverty today. Poverty today is just as awful as poverty was back then. But poverty back then, admittedly, if you were poor, very poor, you were at the mercy of misunderstandings about hygiene. So many people were in a terrible, unhygienic state, crammed into houses, and were subject to natural illnesses that plagued the body. And of course, food was adulterated back then. Not in the same way as today, but by certain things being added to it, of course. Tea had various things shoved in to make it go further. Same with flour and all sorts of things. So the gullible would buy stuff and it would be adulterated, had fillings and all sorts. I mean, I'm sure they put things like plaster and all this sort of stuff into stuff, which... But I get, oh, there's an ambulance going by, another ambulance. We get about 100 ambulances go past now as people are dying left, right and centre, thanks to COVID. But now when you're... And so there was all of that going on. But you had still access 100 years ago, if you weren't in a city, to... Oh, there's another ambulance. You had access to the countryside and you had access... and. To a lot of more natural foods. Now, of course, we're all poisoning ourselves. I say all in brackets, not all of us, clearly, but the majority of people are quite content to poison themselves by going to supermarkets, eating nutrient-free, vitamin-deficient food, stuffed with colourings and chemicals and toxins. They're quite happy to do that to themselves. It is barking. Again, ignorance. But they are quite happy to poison themselves because the effects are very incremental. Doesn't happen all at once. You know, they don't eat a supermarket burger and then keel over and die. But 10 years down the line, they are afflicted with all sorts of illnesses, not just from one set of burgers, but from a, you know, whole load of things. And they can't pin it. Why have I got this illness? Why have I got this? And they can't pin it down to one particular thing because all these things have accumulated. They have an addiction to sugar, an addiction to all sorts of types of food, an addiction to convenience. So they don't make the effort to go. They don't make the effort to go to a farm shop or to a market or to grow stuff themselves. They, you know, it's they go down the convenient thing and they're quite happy to believe all that comes, you know, it's the same old story. All that's shiny isn't necessarily gold. And they look at these shiny boxes of TV dinners, or the shiny appeal of the new church, the church of the supermarket. And they go in then to the congregation, of which the priests have been almost all the priests and the, what would you call them, the vergers of the supermarket, the staff have all been removed and all autonomous, and you're not allowed much time to have a human conversation. In fact, you don't want to, you want to get out of that place so quickly. And now the cameras are facing you and facial recognition is watching you. This is it is a barbaric time, subtly and psychologically barbaric. And people just, we're adaptable creatures, aren't we? And we put up with it. We just put up with it. We don't say, no, I'm putting my foot down. I'm not going there. I'm just not going to the supermarket to be treated like some autonomous number. We kind of go, oh, well, you know, we've got to get round quickly. It's convenient. It's there. I can park. And all of that convenience. Yes, yes, I can go and poison myself and eat all that crap food. But it won't matter. I haven't got to worry about it because I can go to a doctor and have some little white pills that will also meter out the effects of all the poisons and toxins that I'm living in and putting up with, not realizing that those little white pills, of course, have equally number of toxins, which will eventually kill them, because it does admit it, they've got it in the small print. Nobody reads a bloody small print. And there it is, in there. Side effect includes death. Why would you take anything that has a side effect? Why do you want to have something as a side effect? If the side effect isn't invigorated health, why the hell would you want to take it? You ask, you tell me. I mean, I understand that if we were in a war, let's say, you know, and it's the enemy is coming up, we're staving off the enemy like in the First World War, we're pushing back against them and we're having to survive, that would be one thing. You might eat all sorts of things just to survive. But in the last 100 years, apart from during the wars, in so-called sophisticated, cultivated stuff, we've become so stupid and blind. And we are quite happy. And in a way, I understand people have been confused and preyed upon by these dark forces. But also, in a way, we have become stupid and we almost deserve it. Because there are many who are trying to wake people up and say, look, can you not just see what's going on? And clearly they can't. Anyway, my friends, that's a nice waffle for you to get through. I do apologise. A bit of a rant on a Sunday morning, a little sermonette as you go to the supermarket. Prepare to get up and buy some more toxic food to poison yourselves. I haven't been in a supermarket for over a year. I mean, it's creeping up now to almost, I don't know how long. It's difficult to gauge. I just don't go to supermarkets. I just will not go in there. I do go in the corner shop. That's true. There's some things like bleach and things that one at the moment still has to buy the big brands because there are not enough family-run businesses that make the products that I need and would be nice. I would like to see more of those, and I think in time that will happen. But we're still not at the edge. We're getting close to the edge, but we haven't come to the tipping point where survival from the corporations and the big dead entity corporations that people work for, that people, ordinary everyday people, pour in to the satanic mills, which is the supermarkets and the corporations, and work for these bastards, and they don't know. They do it because they need the money. And it's the saddest thing. It's the saddest thing to see and for people not to realise these same corporations are just bleeding everyone, including their workers, taking their energy, forcing them under things like strip lighting at desks all day long, doing basically non-entity work. And people people again are worshipping at the corporation, dead entities, evil, mean, blood-sucking corporations. Give me a town that is run by family-run businesses, craftsmen, artisans. Give me a town that is run by real people with businesses that are meaningful, look after the staff. Give me one of those, or a town or a village, or in which care and love is prominent, and local produce grown from the nearby. Give me that, in which nobody goes, turns their back on these dead entity corporations, especially bloody government ones that pretend to be public authorities, pretend to be benevolent and your friend, but actually the mask has slipped and the snarling evil face is doing deeds. The councils and the government don't seem to say, yes, we'll help you. Yes, we'll do everything in our power to help you, to make your life better, which is what one would have assumed if they were free, if they were honourable, that would be what they're doing. If your council is not saying to you, how can I make your life better, they should not be in power. Simple as. They should not. If they are making your life worse, what the hell are they doing in the position that they're doing? Why have we allowed that to happen? But people just go, oh, councils, yes, that's their... People are being born into this obnoxious situation. It has to change. It just has to change. That's not living. And yet, again, they're swarming into this. People are swarming in and working for these dead entity corporations disguised as government, disguised as civil service, disguised as councils, and they do not realise it. With that, I must go. Thank you so much. Toodle-pip.